Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a hot year for Hollywood women. Meryl Streep in Julie and Julia in It's Complicated, Sandra Bullock in The Proposal and The Blind Side, Catherine Bigelow out in the desert and behind the camera directing The Hurt Locker, Precious, turning heads. So is this it? The moment when Hollywood women finally come into their own after years of second-class status? This hour On Point, is this it? The year of the woman in Hollywood. You can join the conversation. What do you see on the screen, in the box office, behind the camera? Has something changed? Have women arrived? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. At Sunday's Golden Globes ceremony, Meryl Streep accepted the award for Best Performance in a Comedy in Julie and Julia by saying she doesn't play all her film roles for herself.
I just want to say that in my long career, played so many extraordinary women that basically I'm getting mistaken for one. And no, really, I'm very clear about the fact that I'm the vessel for other people's stories and other women's lives.
And Sandra Bullock, who won Best Dramatic Performance for The Blind Side, had kind words for all the other women up for the award.
Thank you, Hollywood Foreign Press, after all these years, and you let me step over to the other side. And thank you for putting me in this extraordinary category with these amazing women I get to share this night with.
With us right now from Los Angeles is Nicole Laporte. She's a writer and critic for the online news site The Daily Beast. She's also a former film critic for Variety magazine, has written for The New Yorker, The LA Times magazine, The New York Times. Nicole Laporte, great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So lay out the elements for us of why people are saying, hey, maybe 2009, maybe the year we're just wrapping up now has been the year of the woman. Why? What's the case that's made?
Well, there were several films both made by women and starring women in the lead roles that just were critically well-received and that did well at the box office, you know, including Julie and Julia, The Blind Side, The Proposal, Precious. And even in films that weren't, a lot of those films were made by women, but even in films not made by women, such as Up in the Air and Avatar, you just had a lot of great roles for women that were smart and interesting and not necessarily just cliched. And then, you know, in Hollywood, it is always about the money. And when a film like The Blind Side, starring Sandra Bullock, which really she's basically the lead, it's a drama, you know, and typically a female-driven drama makes maybe $40 million, $50 million. Mm-hmm. That film recently made over $200 million. So when that starts happening, you know, Hollywood definitely starts taking note.
Here's a little clip from The Blind Side, starring Golden Globe winner Sandra Bullock as the white, well-to-do Leanne Toohey. She befriends a young black 17-year-old Michael Orr, played by Quentin Aaron, who's in foster care. He becomes part of the Toohey family, later is drafted into the NFL for the Baltimore Ravens. Here's Sandra Bullock as Leanne, defending with her friends her decision to welcome the young black man into her home.
Look, here's the deal. I don't need y'all to approve my choices, all right? But I do ask that you respect them. You have no idea what this boy's been through, and if this is going to become some running diatribe, I can find an overpriced salad a lot closer to home.
Leanne, I'm so sorry. We didn't intend to...
No, we didn't, really.
I think what you're doing is so great.
To open up your home to him? Honey, you're changing that boy's life.
No. He's changing mine.
Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side. Back in 06, we spoke with writer Michael Lewis about the book The Blind Side, and we spoke with the real-life Leanne Toohey. You can listen back to that conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. Nicole Laporte, all right, it's got a $200 million box office, which is a big deal. Sandra mm-hmm. Bullock's right at the heart of it, but it's still about football in a way. I mean, it doesn't exactly seem like a women's movie, or maybe that's not the way to think about it.
Football definitely factors in, but there's actually a lot less football in the film than there is in Michael Lewis's book. And they really did craft that film to be kind of this family feel-good story. So I think it's, you know, I think they have gotten some football fans in there, but I think primarily that film plays as a family movie, you know, with a strong female character, you know, with good moral values. And, you know, it's a very uplifting tale. That movie's done well all across the country, you know, in the heartland. And, you know, it's just a film that's really appealing to, as they say here, you know, all four quadrants. So I think it's, they have squeaked a little bit of, or some football in, but primarily it's more just a great story with a great female character.
So when people talk about the bar that many women say they've never quite cleared in Hollywood, box office is one piece of it. And there's an example of big box office. Roles are another. Backstage or back screen power is another, whereas as director or studio executive, take us into those other categories of roles and power off screen, Nicole.
Definitely the studio, you know, the studio executive role and is important. And right now there are really just a few women running studios. You have Amy Pascal at Sony. Stacey Snyder is at DreamWorks. But, you know, we're actually down in count from a few years earlier. So that's, you know, that's one sort of less uplifting aspect. And then director is another area where there are really, really few women working. And you know, the fact that Kathryn Bigelow has done so well this year and is getting so much attention for The Hurt Locker is fantastic, because historically there just aren't a lot of female directors out there. So those, you know, those are behind the scenes. Producers, there do tend to be more female producers, although still male dominated overall. But I would say the director and the executive ranks are where we're probably hurting the most.
Hurt Locker got a lot of attention, a lot of critical acclaim. Very tough story about the bomb disposal unit in Baghdad, directed by Kathryn Bigelow. Kind of a tough setting, desert and war and blood. Here's a little bit from that suspense-filled drama, directed by Kathryn Bigelow.
You realize every time you suit up, it's life or death.
Found something.
You roll the dice. And you deal with it.
A great film directed by Kathryn Bigelow, The Hurt Locker there. Here's James Cameron, who directed the blockbuster Avatar, accepting the Golden Globe for Best Director, said he had had tough competition from his ex-wife, Kathryn Bigelow, thought it might have been her that would win.
I'm actually not well prepared because, frankly, I thought Kathryn was going to get this, so I'm kind of winging it here. And she richly deserves it, but make no mistake, I'm very grateful.
James Cameron saying maybe the ex should have won it. Of course, she didn't. He did. Manola Dargis joins us right now from Los Angeles. She's chief film critic at the New York Times. Manola, welcome back to One Point. Great to have you.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Tom.
And so we see some of the evidence is put on the table, and Nicole Laporte's been laying some of that out for us kindly enough from L.A. as well. But you're not buying the idea of a Year of the Woman in Hollywood. Why not, Manola?
Well, I guess I'll buy the Year of the Woman when we stop having conversations like this, if you know what I mean. The fact that we actually even have to discuss it seems to me proof that we're kind of bending over backward to explain, well, it's not as bad as it usually is. I mean, granted, there have been some interesting films this year for women. Meryl Streep, in fact, at the Golden Globes, which I usually try to avoid, a little bit more interesting this year, did mention that it seems like it might be getting a little bit better for women. But it's hard to know. It's hard to know if this is actually an exceptional year or if this is actually the beginning of some sort of sea change. Certainly it's long overdue.
Well, look at the roles with us for a moment, if you would, Manola. Do you see roles that are groundbreaking here? I mean, on the one hand, there's been a lot of attention to Meryl Streep and Sandra Bullock. But I'm not – I don't know if these qualify as – epic, groundbreaking roles?
I don't see anything groundbreaking about either of those roles. I think what's exciting is that there are meaty roles for women, and these are movies that are actually getting audiences and really seem to be supported by their companies that are releasing them, and that's very exciting. You know, Hollywood was built both on female and male stars equally, and for, you know, decades upon decades, you had very strong, powerful women who had long careers well into their middle ages. And that really changed over the last couple decades. So, you know, to see any sort of shift back to normalcy is really pretty exciting. I just think it's too soon for us to start saying, yes, you know, really the times have changed.
Nicole, why do you think people, they seem to want to say that? Why is it? There's an urge to crown it as the year of the woman. Where's that come from?
You know, Hollywood loves sound bites and Hollywood loves new trends. And, you know, when you have several films of a certain type do well, everyone likes to claim, ah, that's the secret formula.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, that's one thing. And Hollywood also likes to feel good about itself and feel that it's not just a boys club. And so I think there's, you know, there's a desire to think that change is afoot. But I agree with Manola. I mean, I think it's too early to tell. And, you know, we'll see in the next few years what happens.
And Manola, you've been pretty tough saying kind of cut the bull. It is a boys club.
Well, yes, but I'm only pointing out the obvious, really. I mean, you know, I think that if there's anything unusual about the fact that I've been pointing it out, it's only because, you know, most of the movie critics, certainly in the mainstream in America, are men, and they may not necessarily be looking at this. Nicole can back me up on this. I mean,
yeah.
The world that we work in is, you know, predominantly male, and we go to movies that are made for men, by men, for men, and so when something kind of shifts a little bit in the landscape, you know, the few of us out there who are kind of also paying attention to the rest of the population are going to wave our hands. And I think Nicole's absolutely right. This is the kind of thing that, you know, Hollywood can then embrace as if it were some sort of sign of its own progressiveness. But let's not be fooled.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women in Hollywood and the buzz of a big year. Manola Dargis, chief film critic for the New York Times, is with us from L.A. Nicole Laporte from the Daily Beast is here as well. Here's Sandra Bullock with a little more talking to reporters after the Golden Globes about progress and headwinds for women.
It's still a little bit there, but it's gotten so much better. I mean, I look back in my year and I go, wow, two great successes for me were written by men. The Proposal and The Blind Side. So I just feel if you write it, they will come. But you also need to get a studio to finance it. There's so many variables. But I think if you look at what Sarah Jessica Parker has done, Meryl Streep, I mean, women do pull in some money, and we do go to the theaters.
There's After the Golden Globes on the screen. Here's just a bit from Julia and Julia, written and directed by Nora Ephron. Tells the story of the celebrated chef Julia Child and her time in France in the 1950s, where she first discovers French cooking. Here she is having a meal out. She's played by Meryl Streep, of course, and her husband, Paul, Stanley Tucci, talk about how she should best spend her time in France.
I saw a notice on the bulletin board at the embassy for hat-making lessons.
You like hats?
I do.
What is it that you really like to do?
Eat.
I know. And you are so good at it. Look at you. Now,
how growing good you are. In front of you.
She liked to eat. She liked to cook. Julia Childs and Meryl Streep made a great role of it there in Julie and Julia. Manola Dargis, Nicole Laporte, let me put the question to you about what the movies might look like if women really sort of had equal throw weight in Hollywood. Manola, what would be different?
Well, a woman might make Transformers 3. I mean, what I'd like to see is women getting out of the kind of genre ghettos that they tend to be. And I think one of the things that's most interesting about Kathryn Bigelow, of course, is that she does not make what is traditionally thought of as women's pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not making romantic comedies. And if anything, a lot of her career has been to kind of go against that tide. She's a genre director working in genres that are often wrongly, but often correctly associated with male directors. You know, so she's really kind of stayed away from that, I think in part because she didn't want to be pigeonholed as a woman director. You know, I'm sure Nicole, like me, does not want to be thought of as a
mm-hmm.
woman writer.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be thought of as writers.
And she's broken through. Here she is. Of course, she did Point Break and Blue Steel. In an interview with The Guardian last summer, this is Kathryn Bigelow, the director, was asked about how she chose such tough locations for shooting her movies.
You know, working with an environment around you and keeping it very evocative and inviting and aspirational, even if it's painfully dangerous, it's still, you know, there's something kind of seductive about it. And I think that's goes hand in hand with the medium.
Nicole LaPorte, how rare is Kathryn Bigelow in the kind of projects she takes on? The Hurt Locker was kind of tough and gritty and a tough environment for shooting, as you could find. Does that put her in a class of her own among women directors?
Yes, definitely. I mean, like Manola was saying, most of the women directors out there are kind of staying in the safe territory of the romantic comedy. You know, I remember in 1997 when Mimi Leder was chosen to direct The Peacemaker, which was an action movie starring George Clooney and Nicole Kidman. You know, it was huge news. It was a New York Times big story. And, you know, I remember a quote from Mimi saying something like, yeah, you know, I think they expected me to show up wearing combat boots. Mm-hmm. And there is this kind of perception that, you know, I think Hollywood likes to romanticize, you know, film sets and itself. And there's kind of this idea that a set is every set is like Apocalypse Now, and the crew is in revolt and the right. stars are melting down, and you need to have this big brawny actor wearing aviator glasses, you know, booming into a megaphone. And you know what I love about all the publicity Kathryn Bigelow is getting is that you're seeing, you know, there's like photos of her on these sets and she looks tough and great and but still very feminine. And I, you know, it sounds very superficial, but I think it's important, you know, to sort of get it out there that, you know, there's this type, or you know, that someone like that can do a great job, you know, directing an action movie.
Manola, but that kind of suggests that if you had women sort of 50-50 in the film business, you'd have more of you'd have women making war movies, or more, as you said, you know, Terminator 16. Why not? But is that what you'd expect? More of the same?
But I don't expect. I mean, I'm not. You know, I believe that women are just as good as men, and women are just as bad as men. And I don't expect that they're going to bring better taste, you know, or anything else. All I would like to see is that women directors have a fair shake, that they get to explore a range of work, and they get to tell different kinds of stories, that they don't have to consistently tell the same tired story again and again. You know, and I like part of Julie and Julia, but I don't really see it as a big breakthrough that this is a biopic. First of all, we've had a lot of biopics mm-hmm. about dead women. Of course, there's one live woman, but still.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I just don't see that as a breakthrough, and I enjoyed Meryl Streep's performance, as I always do. I would just like to see women get the same exact chance, including the same exact chance that men get to fail. And one of the things that we both, you know, that we all know about mm-hmm. Hollywood is that women cannot fail the way that men can fail in Hollywood and still come back.
Give us an example of that, Manola.
Mimi Leder was a perfect example. Mm-hmm. You know, the Peacemaker doesn't make a lot of money. She just, her career, I mean, Nicole, what happened, right?
Well, she did go on to make Deep Impact, but
exactly.
That, I think, was, you know, I think she started that before Peacemaker actually came out. But you're right. Peacemaker didn't do that great, and I believe, and I mean, Leder's a wonderful director, but I believe she's back in TV now, and, you know, she's clearly not Jim Cameron.
And what about guys in a comparable position?
We could go down the list. I mean, one of my favorites, Michael Mann, you know, he's not been, you know, spends a lot of money, doesn't always necessarily make a lot of money. He might make it, you know, in ancillaries, which to translate out of industry speak would be things like, you know, DVDs. But there are lots of, I mean, there are more male failures than I can possibly point to, and yet they consistently are able to make movies. It's just not true of women. I mean, Kimberly Pierce would be another example who, you know, listeners might most know from Boys Don't Cry, a really wonderful movie, and she went on to make actually an Iraq war theme movie, Stop Loss, and I haven't heard a peep out of her. That was didn't do well. So there's just that's empirical. That's not just my opinion. You know, the failure rate for women, you cannot consistently fail the way that men can in Hollywood.
Manola, Nicole, stand by. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. Jacqueline in Amherst, Massachusetts. Jacqueline, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd love to know when women are going to start making and acting in and writing movies like The Hangover, and when we're going to see the raunchy, buddy, outrageous comedies like that, when we're going to see a little bit more of what women really do, not just things like Baby Mama or, you know, these silly little comedies.
Right, raunchy, buddy movies by and for women. When's that coming, Manola?
I don't know, but I'm looking forward to it. I think people who know me, who know me outside the New York Times, know that I definitely have a raunchy side to me. So I look forward to that.
Nicole, have you seen the screenplay for that? Is it circulating out there already?
Well, we started to actually see that a little bit, I think, last year with films like The House Bunny and The Ugly Truth, and those actually were written by women. And yet again, it was the same kind of thing where it generated all these stories, and it was like, oh, my God, women writing, you know, Judd Apatow-like movies. So it was one of those things where you were very excited, but you're like, oh, God, you know, why does this have to be major news?
But, Nicole, don't you think, I mean, the problem for me is something like The Ugly Truth is, you know, people had problems with The Hangover and there was accusations of it being sexist, you know. I think The Ugly Truth, which was written by women and was, made at a studio run by a woman, you know, was much more sexist than The Hangover. I mean, that was so depressing to me.
Yeah.
That was a movie that just basically put forth the most kind of reprehensible ideas about women and gender and relationships with men.
Let's get Shannon in Concord, Massachusetts. Shannon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I think this is a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for it.
Yeah.
I'm an aspiring screenwriter and producer. I worked on my first film set this past fall, and I was an assistant director. And the director of photography was a woman and her assistant, as well as many women on the set.
Okay.
And I guess that's kind of a new thing, and most of the guys on the set told me that was, you know, things seem to be changing and more women are present. So that's one great thing. The other thing, I wanted to suggest or ask, I guess, your guests, I've noticed in studying screenwriting and producing even more that I guess there, to the extent that you can predict a formula for filmmaking and try to follow it, you know, that's a really difficult thing to do and try to figure out what's going to make a good film. And I wonder if a lot of the persistent hurdles that are there for women in filmmaking have to do with the fact that the formula that Hollywood has been following for so long has been largely male-authored and male-driven.
And kind of set in stone. Let us pick it up. Manola, what about it? We know formulas are very persistent. Are they the boundaries?
Yeah, so I think because Hollywood is basically a very conservative business, you know, even despite the accusations of liberalism, this is very conservative. Something works, you do it again. That's why we have genres, you know. This works, let's do it again, and let's do it again until the audience gets tired, and then we shift over here and repeat the formulas. And I think that I would, you know, I think the problem of, you know, women in Hollywood and what is the problem, what is Hollywood's problem with women, in part has to do with because of things like you have a great big success, a lot of boys go see it, it's got male stars, well, there, therefore we somehow assume women don't want to go to movies. Well, maybe women don't want to go to that specific film. And I'm always really entertained and appalled by how many reporters are always surprised when women actually turn out for a movie. You know, Sex and the City is a surprise hit. Mamma Mia is a surprise
because they think it's a boys' game going to movies.
Yes.
Or what?
Yes, exactly. And Hollywood has been basically aimed at the juvenile market since the 1950s, and it's been kind of during the last 40 years, women have increasingly been kind of squeezed out of that equation, and so there's a kind of weird logic that they keep replicating.
So, Nicole, I mean, that's interesting. Even the audiences get judged in gender terms in the Hollywood world.
Yeah, definitely, because that's who's, you know, buying movie tickets. But I think one of the interesting takeaways from what happened last year is that the case was made that women do come and they do see movies and they do, you know, buy tickets. And that matters. I mean, that does get Hollywood to notice. And, you know, Hollywood's always trying to make movies for the prize demo of, you know, the 13-year-old boy, but they're now realizing the 13-year-old boy has his iPhone and his video games and, you know, doesn't need to go out and see it. But older women, actually, they do want to go to the theater and they go in groups. And so I think there is this little discovery this year that, you know, that's actually a very interesting and important demographic that is worth seeking out whilst the 13-year-old boy is playing his Xbox.
And what about evolution in the formulas, if there's any out there, Manola? As women make progress here, do you see new formulas emerging or new takes on old formulas that have a different perspective gender-wise?
Well, I mean, we'll have new perspectives, but I'm not so sure about formulas. I mean, this, you know, one of the reasons that Hollywood has been so successful is it's very good at formulas. That's what they do. You know, they produce much of the same with a little bit of difference, and that's basically how Hollywood was built into a multinational, you know, phenomenon. So I don't really see necessarily the formulas, but you can kind of change it a little bit, and you have different kinds. So you have women doing it, and you have more black people doing it, and Asian people. I mean, the thing is, it's just I would like to just see a little less of the kind of overwhelming sameness that we are struck with. I just think it's kind of ironic sometimes that you can look back at the classical Hollywood films of the 40s and 50s and sometimes feel like there's actually more diversity there. I mean, the one saving grace that we have is a kind of, you know, an independent film world, but that work has a hard time finding a toehold next to big Hollywood movies.
Yeah, no kidding. Here's a little bit from Bright Star, New Zealand director Jane Campion's film about English poet John Keats and his love affair with his next-door neighbor, Fanny Braun. In the film, Keats, played by Ben Whishaw, confronts his best friend, Charles Armitage Brown, played by Paul Schneider, after Brown sends a mocking Valentine to Keats' lover.
It was only a jest.
For whom? I'm not laughing. Miss Braun is not laughing.
John, I wrote the Valentine to amuse Fanny, who makes a religion of flirting. John, she is what, a poetry scholar one week and what, a military expert the next? It is a game. It is a game to her. She collects...
There is a holiness to the heart's affections. No, you know nothing of that.
There's a holiness to the heart's affections. Maybe only Keats could speak like that. Two guys going back and forth, but it's Jane Campion directing. Is this a formula breaker, Nicole, or in the, I don't know, Merchant Ivory realm?
I mean, I think it's what's interesting about the Bright Star, or the fact of the matter, is that it's not a blind side. It's not a big Hollywood movie, you know, and it's Jane Campion. It's an artist making the film, and it's a beautiful film. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just to bring it back to the conversation of how this changes things, you know, the Bright Side didn't make a lot of money. It's more critically beloved. And therefore, I think, you know, you have wonderful performances, but I don't know that this is not the kind of thing that causes kind of the paradigm shift in Hollywood. So it's, you know, it's a wonderful movie, but what, anyway, I'm not sure how it's going to change things going forward.
Let's get a call from Waynesboro, Virginia. Jim, you're on the air.
Tom, thank you. Mm-hmm. First, I'd like to tell you again how much I enjoy this program.
Thank you.
This is only my second time calling. The other time was the program shortly before President Obama appointed a Hispanic American to the Supreme Court, when I offered up the suggestion that perhaps he should appoint a Native American woman to the Supreme Court.
You're covering all the bases, thinking back to Sonia Sotomayor. What about in the movies, Jim?
I came pretty close. Well, that's the dovetail into my comment and my proposition that perhaps this does indeed signal an overall shift, not only in the movies, but also in politics. We have Obama being elected. We have Obama appointing a Hispanic American to the Supreme Court. We have a conversation today about women making a greater impact in the important medium of the movies. And I think the proposition might be justice and fairness and inclusion of women, which I applaud that. I think that does signal a shift in the American public, perhaps not so much having been not so much sensed yet by our Congress and our lawmakers, who seem to be struggling to find what the American people are saying.
Jim, you've got a buoyant view, and I like it. Manola, do you see justice, fairness, and inclusion sweeping over Hollywood like a great sea?
No. I wish for it. I mean, I think the very fact that a conversation is taking place is a hopeful sign. But, you know, we've had these conversations in the past. I remember when a movie called Fried Green Tomatoes came out and was a really big, unexpected hit, and there was a lot of talk about that. And it wasn't that long ago that Hollywood had the Year of the Woman, even though there were no movies that year. And so this is a kind of cyclical thing, and it is a problem, but it is always heartening when the conversation at least picks up again.
I I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women in Hollywood, the buzz of a big year in 2009, and we're asking what's changed, if something has changed. Manila Dargis of the New York Times joins us from Los Angeles, as does Nicole Laporte of the Daily Beast. Precious made a big splash this year based on the novel Push by Sapphire, highly acclaimed. Tells the story of Clarice Precious Jones, an overweight, pregnant, illiterate African-American teenager in Harlem. Mary, her abusive mother, played by Monique, stops by at a session here with the social worker, played by Mariah Carey. In her first movie, Gabourey Sidibe plays Precious, listening to Monique as her mother spins her side of a complicated story.
And me and Carl, we love Precious. And you need to know that. We love Precious, and we had dreams. Precious was born around the same time Miss West's son got killed. The summertime. She was born the summertime. Remember that?
I was born in November.
November. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. No, Mom, I was not born in the summertime. Here's the Precious star, Gabourey Sidibe. This is an interview with CBS. She was asked how it feels to be a large woman, not a typical look for Hollywood, and suddenly become famous.
It's empowering. It's like, as much confidence as I have, there's still a fat little girl that lives inside of me, because everyone told me that I wouldn't make anything of myself until I lost 100 pounds.
And here's Monique, who won Best Supporting Actress at the Golden Globes for her role in Precious. In an emotional speech, she acknowledged her co-star, Gabourey.
To Gabby, sister, I am in awe of you. Thank you for letting me play with you.
Manila Dargis, New York is your town. Groundbroken in Precious?
Yeah, I actually think Precious is an important movie. Again, though, I am concerned, I do think that we won't know if it is a groundbreaking movie until there's another film that is about a black woman's story. You know, we're going to need to see more than just one movie about a black woman before we understand that this is a groundbreaking film.
Is there something in the grittiness of this film, the reality that makes it more a women's film, if that's a phrase you recognize, Manila?
Well, I see it definitely as a woman's film, and you know, obviously, I'm coming from a very specific position. You know, I'm a white woman, so I'm going to look at it as a woman necessarily. And I was really struck initially how so much of the conversation about this movie was framed only in terms of race and not in terms of sex and gender issues. I see it in some ways as very much on a continuum of really old-fashioned women's weepies, real melodramas about women who suffer tremendously because they are women. Movies like Stella Dallas, I mean, there is a kind of history of this. For me, this is a very overwrought melodrama. It's very, very moving, and you're tear-streaked at the end of it in a kind of very classic way.
Nicole, I wonder if you would anticipate more in this vein of real gritty, honest intimacy, if women had their hand higher on the till, or does that mean more romantic comedies? Manila doesn't like them.
Like good ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope we see more Precious, films like Precious, which actually was directed by a man, but is such a women's movie, and I love how big it's become. I love that it's this very difficult, dark film that, started off in Sundance and over the course of the year, has made it to the front, the cover of the New York Times Magazine. I love that Monique is kind of a part of the conversation right now and everyone's watching her, but it's, at this point it seems a bit like a diamond in the rough. And again, it remains to be seen if there will be, I can't see studios sitting around commissioning another, an all-black cast that's this dark and gritty and, giving it a budget of more than $5 million. Mm. So this may also fall into that category of small independent film that is a little bit separate from the bigger Hollywood conversation.
Let's get a call from Susan in Columbia, South Carolina. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, yeah.
Love your show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to comment that my sister is teaching high school in her first semester. She was teaching a film class for the first time, and we were having a really hard time talking about films, trying to find one where there was a really strong, wonderful lead women character. There were so many films that we came up with that had strong lead men or very, you know, mob movies, The Godfather, all those. But we had a really, really hard time coming up with ones with strong women characters. And, you know, I don't know if you could recommend some or just comment on the dearth.
Let's do it right here, right now. I mean, African Queen or Million Dollar Baby or Norma Rae or Silence of the Lambs. I don't know. What do you put forward, Manila?
I would start with James Cameron, actually. I mean, you know, I think one of the most interesting things about James Cameron is that he consistently makes movies with really strong women. And it depends on what, you know, we're thinking of as strong. He makes very, you know, movies with women who are strong, both, you know, physically strong, but also psychologically strong. And, you know, I think that he's a really interesting, even his latest film, everyone keeps concentrating on the guy, but...
Avatar, but you're saying look around.
Look around. Look at his films. They consistently have really strong women characters, and it's actually very exciting. And this is true in Terminators 2, even Titanic, if you think about Titanic. And this is also true in Avatar. So.
But if Susan's sister is teaching a high school film class and she wants to put out, you know, from the entire sort of library of American films, she wants to choose a couple that show women in strong lead roles, would you send her to Avatar, or what might you pick from
I'm just saying that that's something that we might overlook because Cameron's a man, but I'm just saying, you know, I'm certainly not the first person to point out that he really likes strong women characters, but you could go back in the history of cinema, you know, starting with the silent era where the first big movie star in this country was Mary Pickford. It's not in the history of cinema. And then moving forward through Hollywood history, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, so forth and so on, into the 70s. Gets a little tougher these days. That's why I picked on James Cameron, because, you know, he's one of the few male directors working today who has strong women characters.
And, Nicole, if you want to point Susan's sister to a couple of, I don't know, maybe classics for her high school class to show strong women in the lead role.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, go back to Katharine Hepburn or, you know, Bringing Up Baby. I mean, I agree. I think it's actually easier when you go back in history to find those films, and it's a little bit harder today. But just when I was thinking about current films, I mean, I think Diablo Cody, you know, did something great with Juno, or at least created a great character, you know, and Jason Reitman in Up in the Air. You know, I do think there are a few films recently that are, you know, showing kind of interesting women that are breaking out of, you know, the cliche.
Let's go to Mandy in Cape Coral, Florida. Mandy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling in reference to the raunchy female comedies that you were talking about earlier, and I'm in the middle of writing a screenplay with that very premise, but with a female as the lead instead of one of the funny guys from Hollywood now, but my problem is getting somebody to look at it seriously, the pages that I already have. So how do you do that?
So what's your drift? Is it like Judd Apatow with women?
It's a Judd Apatow with women as your leads and your supports, and it's got, you know, a lot of the same from the formulas, since you're talking about formulas. Mm-hmm. It's got, you know, illegal uses of substances, and it has references to sexually explicit natures and things like that, but it's from a girl's or a woman's perspective.
Nicole, where do you point Mandy?
Well, first of all, I'd love to see that movie. So please, please write it. Please have it made. Like I said, I mean, I think that's opening up more. I mean, I think there is more acceptance now of, you know, Hollywood films that are raunchy, written by women, for women. So I don't know, maybe if you put Judd Apatow in your log line, Judd Apatow for women, maybe that would sell.
Manoli, any advice?
I always, you know, I'm not really on the industry side of things, but yep. I always feel that if I were a screenwriter, I would definitely be writing for specific stars in mind, because just think about all those talented women, including female comics out there, and, you know, they're all looking for something. You know, they would like some sort of material. They would like to break out the way Adam Sandler did. So I would just be very specific. That's just my little two cents on that.
Yeah, and make them your champions. Mandy, good luck. Mandy to Sandy. Sandy in Newton, Massachusetts. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had the
I thought that while there's the happy development, the great artists like Campion or Bigelow get to make more films, or women get to have strong roles, not just to beat people up, but to be strong in the tradition of Hepburn and Davis, mm-hmm. that some part of that conversation has to do with what happens to men and their roles. And it's a bit reminiscent of television. It's hard to generalize, but it does seem that there's a wave of dysfunctional male roles in which men are portrayed as schlemiels, like in Serious Man, or fops, like Brad Pitt's role, or even if they're positively portrayed with positive feminine traits, like Clooney with empathy and Up in the Air, or the questionable sexuality in Apatow movies or the other bromance movies. That seems somehow on the seesaw with the strength of women's roles.
So women rise in prominence, men's roles become, I don't know, feminized or undercut?
Well, yeah, maybe it's still a men's club, but now the women are the men.
Manola, is there a seesaw here? One goes up, the other goes, I don't know.
No, I would actually argue quite the opposite. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Judd Apatow and the rise of the so-called bromance, romance for brothers, is that the central relationship in those movies is usually between men, you know. And in fact, what's happened is that the best romantic comedies being done right now are by Judd Apatow. They just happen to not be about heterosexual couple. They happen to be about two heterosexual men with the woman off to the side, generally. And I felt that about most of his films. I like some of the movies that he makes and produces very much. It's just that it's kind of devastating in some ways that the best romantic comedies, which is usually an area that women excelled at, you know, and really important for female stars historically, has now been kind of usurped by men.
And Nicole, what about the notion of a sort of seesaw or cause and effect? If women gain power, men's roles in the movie will change, maybe be feminized.
Yeah, I don't really agree with that. And I think, you know, just continuing with the Judd Apatow discussion, mm-hmm. you know, I think what he did that was interesting was he made these male lead characters who aren't, who are completely flawed and, you know, sort of slackers, but he makes them lovable and he kind of makes them heroic in a way. And yet his female characters, you know, that's not happening. They're more to the side. They tend to be less interesting, I think. And I do love his films, but I wish he would sort of develop the women more. And I guess I'm sort of hungry for the woman's version of that, you know, the film where you show women who are flawed and, you know, not beautiful and not perfect and make them lovable and heroic. And I feel like that's missing. I don't think anyone's really turned that into, you know, a real genre, so to speak.
Do you think, Manola, that the Hollywood doors would open for that screenplay if the right one came up? Is that something the execs are ready to see?
I think it really what you'll need is someone like Judd Apatow, someone with that kind of muscle to make it happen, you know. And I feel that it's why I'm excited about Sandra Bullock's kind of resurrection here, mm-hmm. is that, you know, suddenly she does have much more muscle than she's had in the last couple years. And I think if you have someone who's powerful who can say, I want to do this, then it can happen. But we need both Sandra Bullock and Judd Apatow to use their powers for good. That's what we need.
There you go. The force is with them, maybe. David in Toronto. David, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for letting me join the conversation. Mm-hmm. My opinion is that Hollywood has always mirrored back to us our vision of society and social roles and sexual roles. And judging from the way women are portrayed either on television or in advertisements or in Hollywood, that they have to be beautiful and perfect and not have gray hair and not have wrinkles, that it's still going to be quite a while until women can become like men, natural, growing old, gracefully, portraying a strong roles as well as roles of just sexual objects. And I think...
Because age is less well accepted on that front. And we've got it, David. And if you'd permit me, let me twin you with another caller right here from Columbia, South Carolina. Dave in Toronto, thank you. Melody, you're on the air. Melody.
Hi. I was having the comment that I feel we're already in a post-gender society, and I'm a 17-year-old girl, and I think this is one of the most tense situations for,
male overboarding, maybe. And it's always been really equal, and there feels like we don't need all these press conferences that I've seen lately about, you know, women taking over things.
Melody, you're breaking up a little bit, but I think the just 17-year-old homeschooled sees us in a post-gender society already. Manola, then we had David in Toronto saying, you know, women still aren't permitted to be as strong or age gracefully on screen as men are. So can it be both ways at the same time?
Well, I look forward to when she leaves home and goes into the real world. She'll discover she does not live in a post-gender world.
Period. Sorry. End of story to Melody.
Sorry. That's, you know, that the real world is not post-gender, nor...
You know, Manola, you quoted or sort of cited Hollywood execs still quite overt about that. Like, you know, get this woman stuff out of my face sometimes. Is it still just that out there?
Yeah. I mean, I a couple years back, I interviewed, and I'm not going to say who it was, but I interviewed a head of a studio and a woman who point blank told me that she believed that women and men tell better stories, you know, and that because I was asking why she didn't hire a woman to do an action film. And I was thinking at the time of Catherine Bigelow, and this is before The Hurt Locker, and she really was, giving me a kind of sexist explanation that women couldn't tell these kinds of stories. You know, so as long as we have that kind of thinking, as long as we have people who believe that women can only do a certain kind of thing and men can only do a certain kind of thing, we're not going to get very far.
And that was a woman executive in Hollywood.
Yes, it was.
Well, live and learn. Maybe we push the boundaries a little bit this year, the year of the woman or not. Manola Dargis, it's always great to have you with us. I'm really grateful to you for coming on. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Manola Dargis, chief film critic at the New York Times. And Nicole Laporte at the Daily Beast, great to have you with us as well. Thanks so much for joining us from L.A.
Thanks, Tom.
Really great to have you here. Happy viewing. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Also, follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.